Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, September 20th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio is WCAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Cindy McCormick on the tie line from the Cape Cod Times. We'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent, and we'll check in with news from the State House with Catherine Ident and Mike Dean. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Eve, we are starting with you this week because it's been a week of climate action in the news, and I want to touch on some of the highlights from this week. Tell us what's been happening.
Yeah, so really starting from Monday, the week really jumped off on a high note. All four Massachusetts bishops wrote a letter calling for urgent action against climate change. They're calling for their parishioners, schools, businesses to all kind of take care of this earth and curb the impact of target of toxic pollution and climate change. So they called for that right from the start. WCAI spoke with Fall River Bishop Edgar DeCunha about that decision, and he feels really strongly that now is the time to act. And later in this week, just the other day, Greta Thunberg, 16-year-old Swedish climate activist who's kind of been leading this youth climate movement. People are very excited about her. She actually met with our own Massachusetts Congressman Bill Keating, and they talked about climate activism. And Greta Thunberg is in Washington, D.C., and she'll be heading to New York soon for a lot more climate action coming up, but it's been a big week.
One of the big reasons for all this happening is that next week is the UN Summit on Climate Change. Give us a sense of what that's about.
Yeah, so about 60 world leaders are going to be gathering in New York, and it's really the big quote kind of going into that is bring plans, not speeches. It's really focused on action. Many of these world leaders are expected to announce more aggressive goals for cutting planet warming pollution. And while President Trump is not expected to be there, a high-ranking U.S. official is, and California in particular is going to have a good number of leaders showing up and ready to talk about making change.
I want to back up just a little bit to you were talking about the Massachusetts bishops and the letter that they had wrote earlier this week that they released an open letter. They're really calling for people to step forward and take responsibility for climate action as a moral imperative, really, and citing the moral nature of this question.
That's
and this
right.
Issue.
That's right. Fall River Bishop Edgar DeCunha actually described it as, you know, it would be a moral sin to not leave this earth better for our future generations, which I think is a way that the conversation around climate change is changing, and that actually Catholic social teaching explicitly kind of lays out a path for taking care of our earth and our environment. And part of being good Christians, part of being good people, is being stewards of that.
You mentioned this young woman, Greta Thunberg, who is here promoting climate action. And she started something called Fridays. What's it called?
Fridays for Future. That's
Fridays
right.
For Future, right. And this is really a youth climate action, and this is picking up a lot of momentum now and around the Cape, especially young people organizing for events today and tomorrow. Tell us a little bit about what's going to be happening around the Cape today.
Yeah, today is a pretty enormous day. Almost anywhere that you are on the Cape, you can find a rally near you. Starting at 11, I'll just rattle a few off. Starting at 11, a climate strike is planned outside the Cape Cod Commission in Barnstable, where the organizers, 350 Cape Cod, are calling on the commission to make climate change a more central priority in its regional planning. In Falmouth, life jackets are encouraged for a die-in at 10:45 on the Village Green. Representative Dylan Fernandez will be there. And at 11, almost 30 churches, synagogues, Quakers, other faith communities will be ringing their bells in unison at 11 to signify this is the 11th hour. We can't wait to act on climate change anymore. At 3:30 in Truro, Cape teens, kids, they'll be holding court. They'll be talking about what climate change feels like for their generation. But on our website at the CapeandIslands.org, we actually have a resource where every action we've got on there on the islands as well, and really throughout the day and the weekend, actually.
And tomorrow, we're going to see more actions on Saturday?
That's right. Tomorrow in Sandwich, the Cape Cod Climate Strike, a student-led action. That's high schoolers from Falmouth, Sandwich, Barnstable. They'll be leading a conversation at 10 in the morning in Sandwich at Mill Creek Park. And in Falmouth, a global climate strike, take a stand as sea level rise at 4 historical and iconic sites in Falmouth. There will be strikers there letting you know with signs, here's how high the sea level is going to rise here in 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 50 years from now.
You have to wonder a little bit whether Cape youth are just a little more aware of this, a little more energized around this, because living on where we are, right up against the ocean and all the impacts of climate change that are ocean related, that we see and feel them.
I think that's absolutely it. I mean, being a climate reporter for our station, the conversations that I have are, we are the canary in the coal mine. The Cape is a special place. Let's keep a special place special. And there is no greater threat to the specialness of our home than sea level rise, than erosion, than toxic pollution. I mean, these are the existential threats. And I think the younger generation who's grown up with this magic and been told that this magic is under real threat is... they're the ones who know it, and they're the ones who are trying to do something about it.
That's WCAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Thanks, Eve, for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
We are joined now by Cindy McCormick at the Cape Cod Times. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning.
Cindy, more towns are placing restrictions on sales of vaping and flavored tobacco products. Tell us what's happening here.
Yeah, well, this is while state and federal lawmakers are discussing ways to curb the use of e-cigarettes and other vaping products. As you mentioned, these Cape towns are taking action. And it's some of the action is, you know, fairly restrictive. Chatham joined Barnstable to restrict sales of flavored tobacco products that are particularly attractive to young smokers via regulations that went to effect September 1st. And Harwich has joined the Board of Health, voted last week to adopt similar regulations that will go into effect January 1st. Now, these include mint and menthol flavors, as well as the bubblegum and, cotton candy and other flavors that are banned by other towns.
And one of the reasons why they're focusing on mint and menthol is they say that this is kind of a starter flavor for young people to start smoking or getting into tobacco products.
Well, critics say that these flavors, all the flavored e-cigarettes and vaping products, definitely appeal to the younger people. And, these cigarettes, these products are very popular now among middle school students and high school students. The menthol thing is interesting because that's long been associated with cigarettes. People sort of associate it with cigarettes that sometimes thinking of it as a flavor. But Robert Collette, he's with the Cape's Tobacco Control Division, said that menthol is really popular among young smokers. And one reason, he said, it's an anesthetic, so it's not as harsh. They can breathe it deeper into their lungs. Now, flavored cigarettes other than menthol, the cigarettes themselves, were banned by the FDA in 2009.
These communities, what kind of conversation is happening with the businesses in these communities as towns are moving to try to limit the sales?
Well, some communities do not ban the mint and menthol flavors. That's to avoid the pushback from local business owners. So on the Cape, communities that ban like the flavors, the e-cigarette flavors like bubblegum, et cetera, but not menthol, are Brewster, Mashpee, Orleans, Provincetown, Wellfleet, and Yarmouth. And Barnstable, the discussion has gotten a little bit adversarial. Cumberland Farms has filed a lawsuit against Barnstable, and that is still pending in Suffolk Superior Court. And the company argues that restrictions arbitrarily forced it to stop selling the products while allowing competing businesses to continue selling them, because products are allowed to be sold to people 21 and older, and also that they're restricted to adult-only businesses in these particular towns, such as smoke shops. And they're saying, you're creating unfair competition between us and the smoke shop for the over 21 crowd.
The Cape's Senator Julian Sear weighing in here and kind of giving credit to the local towns for leading this effort.
Yes, he said this is a really terrific example of municipalities taking the initiative to make sure they're doing everything they can to protect public health. And talking about youth, the new tobacco restrictions in Chatham were actually prompted by Monomoy Middle School students. And they made several presentations that really impressed the Board of Health.
Cindy, I want to ask you about a story that you reported this week. It's looking at how calls to the region's suicide hotline are going unanswered.
Yes, well, this was the experience of a West Barnstable woman who called the paper, Jerry Moore, and she had she felt lonely, she felt isolated, so she called the two numbers that are actually, if you approach, you know, we had a photo in the paper of the Sagamore Bridge with a sign, "If you're desperate, call the Samaritans." So she called those numbers.
A sign that most people are familiar with. It's been there forever, and it seems like when you cross the bridge, it's one of those iconic things you see.
It is so iconic. I couldn't remember whether it was there or not because it's become sort of wallpaper. So we sent our photographer out. And yes, it is. It is still there. But what happened is that, you know, the phones would ring three times and then disconnect. And to her, that was very upsetting. She was, you know, she felt that that's a sign that that no one cared, that you're actually building up your courage to reach out and ask for help, and then actually literally being disconnected. And we here in the paper tried calling the line several times. We were also disconnected. And then another issue was that, and these numbers are listed on the Cape and Islands Suicide Prevention Coalition page. And another, and there's a different Samaritans number that's on the Massachusetts website, the state website for suicide prevention, and that's an 877 number for the Samaritans. You're supposed to be able to call that from anywhere in the state and be connected. But what would happen is when you were calling from the Cape is you were being told that that number was no longer in service. And so I did talk with someone in the Boston Samaritans office, and they said they would look, they were put in a ticket to fix that, and they thought it must be a routing problem. As of Wednesday night, it had not been fixed, but they said that they considered it an urgent matter and are going to look at the routing issue.
And the Samaritans on the Cape, what do they say about how this is staffed and what's going on here?
Well, they say they need more volunteers. They get, you know, 1,400 to 1,600 calls a month. That's 200 more calls than at this time last year. And Director Stephanie Kelly said they're definitely looking for more volunteers. She said that callers would prefer to hear a ring rather than to get a voice message saying, you know, the volunteer is on another line. She said that she's been told that the ringing gives people hope. But when I talked to a West Barnstable woman, that's not how she felt at all. And she did end up she tried calling over more than a week's time, and then she did end up calling at 9 o'clock on Sunday night the Barnstable police, who sent two officers to her home to talk to her, and she said they were terrific.
To give a sense of the service this provides, I just want to underscore what you said briefly there, which is that they get 1,400 to 1,600 calls a month at the Samaritans hotline,
right.
and that the suicide rate for the Cape is actually higher than other parts of the state.
Yeah, it's 1.5 times higher than the state average. So there's definitely a need out there. And there are a lot of people out there who just feel isolated. They're not living near family. They, if they're older, their friends may have passed away already, and they need a voice they need someone to reach out to. Now, I did try calling the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and that picked up right away. You did get a voice recording saying, hold on. And so I held on, and then someone picked up. I also tried calling the Trevor helpline. That is for LGBT youth and young adults, and someone did pick up.
I was interested even to learn that the Cape hotline is not 24 hours anymore. I didn't know that.
No. Stephanie Kelly from Samaritans on Cape Cod and the island said that about 3 to 4 years ago, they had to restrict their hours to between 8 a.m. and 10:30 p.m. And because just the lack of overnight volunteers, the lack of being able to staff the overnight volunteers. I did speak to a suicide prevention and crisis hotline expert at Columbia University, a psychologist, and she maintains that if you can't get enough volunteers to staff a hotline, don't have it, because you know, you don't want to run into the situation where there is nobody at the end of a line that you're reaching out for help.
Mm. Let's talk about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. A recall election for tribal leaders was scheduled for last weekend, but it was canceled before it could happen.
Yes, and this has infuriated the council member behind the recall effort. That's Aaron Toby, and he plans to file a complaint and request an injunctive relief with the tribal court so that they can hold hold this recall election.
What do we know about why it was canceled and what this is all about?
Well, this is a recall against the council chairman, Cedric Cromwell, and the treasurer, Gordon Harris. And there's been a lot of controversies and division among tribal members about their role in the tribe and the tribe's finances. So they've had this recall election. They collected enough signatures on a petition to hold this recall election. But basically, the election committee canceled it, and Aaron Tobey maintains that the election committee exceeded its authority. And he is asking the court to order the election committee to schedule a recall election within the next 30 days. And he said, you know, the petitions were certified as sufficient by this very same election committee several months ago. But there was the recall itself is, you know, pretty controversial, as you would imagine. It was going to be the first that was scheduled, such election scheduled by the tribe. And efforts have been underway to stop it ever since the petition signatures were certified in April. And for a tribal spokeswoman said, she gave kind of a cryptic explanation for the cancellation. She said it's based on the language of the August 22nd court case and did not elaborate beyond that.
But and then a lawyer, I guess, for Aaron Tobey weighs in here and kind of says that they're obscuring the issue here, that it's not based on that at all, really.
Right, exactly, because this was a whole different complaint. This is against the election. This complaint was dismissed by the tribal court judge because apparently there were not enough signatures on a petition for a recall notice on tribal council vice chairwoman Jessie Little Doe Baird, and the petition fell short of the 100 signatures needed for her recall vote, and a tribal judge dismissed the petitions as insufficient as presented and dismissed Toby's complaint. But that was in a totally separate thing. That was like these petitions already certified. I mean, it was already certified that there were enough signatures for Cromwell and Harris.
And kind of the background here is that the tribe is working on trying to develop a casino in Taunton, and this is a $500 million investment for an outside company. Then people have concerns about where this money has gone. It's a huge debt for the tribe, and there's a lot of questions here, I think, that has promoted this recall move.
Yeah, there's a lot of disappointment over what's happened, of course, with a casino in Taunton that was supposed to provide tribes with many jobs and income. And basically what's happening now is that they have the backer of the casino, who Genting Malaysia, has withdrawn its support after writing off more than a $440 million investment in the tribe as a loss in 2018, and that forced a round of layoffs at the Mashpee Wampanoag headquarters. And of course, the Taunton Casino has been facing fierce opposition by neighbors and lawsuits and all kinds of legal action. So this is, you know, the tribe is, you know, there's a lot of dissension going on. How did this happen? What happened to money? What happened basically, because what they were hoping would be a boon for the tribe has turned out not to be so.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Cindy, you have a story on the front of the Cape Cod Times today about a young woman from Gatamit whose medical difficulties are being made more challenging by what advocates say is an insurance system that's really not recognizing her needs. The young woman's name is Nicole Goodman. Tell us about this.
Yeah, Nicole has been suffering for 8 years with mitochondrial disease and dystonia, and this she's had a fairly independent life. I mean, this is a rare disease, and it's very difficult to live with. One of her legs is just kind of frozen into place at an angle, and she has virtually no use of her left arm. She's developing tremors on her right leg. But what really happened, what set things back for her quite a bit, was when she developed tongue spasms, and this is part of the disease. She developed it this summer. This is a life-threatening condition that can actually block her airway. She was hospitalized for most of the summer, and now that she's home, she really needs round-the-clock nursing care. But her mother, Heather Alden, said that they've been told, well, and Nicole herself, she's very articulate and advocates for herself. And her mother, Heather Alden, said that Medicare, which is her insurer because she's disabled, is refusing to pay for a private nurse at the home, even for part of the day, and that the alternative is to go to a nursing home.
This is such a difficult story, and you can understand the frustration here, the family. What are some of the avenues that they're pursuing to try to make this come together for them?
Well, one of the things the mother herself has written to different officials and legislators, and they reached out to Congressman Keating's office, who in the office said that they are looking into this, and they were quite concerned. And also the Nicole Goodman's social worker, Deb Berglund, was very upset, and she said that she's been a social worker for years, but she's so outraged by this that she took the step of contacting writing media outlets, with the family's permission, of course, media outlets and state and federal officials regarding the situation. She said it's a broken situation, and Nicole Goodman's condition just isn't fitting into these little boxes. For instance, she's not on a ventilator yet, thank goodness, but they just don't recognize, it's like the insurer just doesn't recognize the level of care that's needed. Now, the family, there is some hope. Alden and Goodman had a 45-minute teleconference Wednesday with representatives of the State Executive Office of Health and Human Services, and they were told at that time that their case would be a priority.
Hmm. Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
We're going to speak now with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you today?
George, I am doing well. Thanks for joining us. A tragic and kind of perplexing story, George, this week about an Oak Bluffs man, a member of the fire department, who was shot and killed in Fall River.
Yeah, this is Eric Voschel, and he was in Fall River, as you said. He was at a place called JC's Cafe, he was killed in what is being described in court records as a gang-related incident. Eric was a member of the Sidewinders, which is an affiliate of Hell's Angels, and there was a competing motorcycle club there, the Outlaws, and the two of them had a confrontation outside the cafe. It started as a fight. Someone pulled out what looked like a pipe on videotape, according to the records. And Joseph Jojo Noe is charged in the shooting. Police allege that he pulled out a gun, shot five or six shots. Two other people were injured, and Eric was hit in the back of the head, and the wounds from that shooting, ultimately he died from those at a Rhode Island hospital. We have a lot of details in the story about the allegations in this case. It's particularly sad because Eric does have a wife and children here on the island.
Known in the community.
Right. Member of the fire department, and he had not returned to the fire department yet as a result of injuries he sustained about a year ago in a motorcycle crash on the island. And the community rallied at that point with a GoFundMe and a spaghetti dinner. I'm sure we talked about that at the time on the radio as well. And, yeah, the fire chief we spoke to, he was devastated to hear this news. He said everybody is in a state of shock, described Eric as a lovable guy, the type of guy everybody wanted to be around. And so today, yesterday was his wake, and today is the funeral services. And there are about 200-plus bikers here on the island. They've come over on the ferry in various times over the last couple of days to pay tribute to him at his funeral. So, this is going to be an ongoing story for the next weeks and months ahead as Mr. Noe goes to trial on these charges in Fall River.
Let me ask you about another story that you have. This is about Joanne Murphy, who's retiring as the Dukes County Veterans Agent. And the article in your paper, it's just a fantastic profile by Jack Shea.
Yeah, Jack did a great job with this, as he always does. He profiled Joanne Murphy, who's been the Veterans Agent for about 20 years now here on the island. And she's had quite a distinguished career in the military, but here on the island is where she really distinguished herself, really going to bat for veterans of all shapes and sizes. making sure that they're getting the benefits that they deserved and earned in the military. And she's also, the commander of one of the clubs here, the American Legion in Vineyard Haven, which she plans to continue working on that. And she's going to help out with, as you would expect from Joanne, she's going to help out with the person who's taking her place. But it's a really interesting story, about what it was like for both a woman to be in the military and also what it was like for her when she arrived on the island. You know, not an easy place by any means for folks who don't have a lot of money. She had to work a couple of different jobs while she was raising a family on the island. Talks about her being the delivery person for newspapers, which we certainly appreciate.
And as you say, the journey to where she is now and being able to give back so much to the community, it's a great story, a very powerful story.
Yeah, absolutely. Joanne will be missed in this role, but we're convinced that she's not going too far away.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. We're going to speak now with Tim Wood over at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, there's a plan to allow recreational coyote hunting on the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge, and that plan now appears to be scrapped. Tell us about this.
Sure. Last spring, the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge here in Chatham announced a draft plan to allow waterfowl hunting and coyote hunting on South Monomoy Island. This was part of an expansion of recreational opportunities, mainly through hunting, on more than 70 refuges across the country that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife announced. Last week, they announced that the waterfowl hunting part of the plan would be implemented, but they were dropping the coyote hunting aspect, and that was due mostly to public opposition. The proposal drew about 48 comments, and only three were in favor of coyote hunting, and really just one of them supported it as recreational activity. The other two that were in favor saw it as a way to cull coyotes from the island to control, to protect the nesting birds out there. Now, in addition, the refuge, they were unable to consult with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration about the impact that coyote hunting might have on the thousands of seals that haul out of South Monomoy.
Explain for us a little bit about that. What kind of impact could it have had on the seal population?
Well, there was a buffer that was proposed between the shore, the eastern shore of Monomoy, which is where most of the gray seals hang out, and the hunting area. What the concern was perhaps gunshots sparking the seals, going into the water, disturbing the seals. You know, as you know, seals are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which is administered by NOAA. And a large part of the main comment period for this hunting plan came during the government shutdown last year. So refuge manager Matt Hillman said that there just wasn't enough information available to determine what kind of an impact coyote hunting could have on the seals out there. So that was sort of a secondary reason that they decided to scrap that plan. Matt Hillman also said that, coyote hunting seems to be falling out of favor. He noted that the so-called killing contests that we all heard about on other parts of the Cape kind of resulted in a lot of opposition and protests. So the other aspect of this was that coyote hunting was going to be allowed basically during the winter and basically for a very short period. And, as we all know, it's pretty inhospitable out there on Monomoy at that time of year. So they didn't expect a lot of hunting to happen anyway. So given all the other issues, they decided to drop that aspect of the plan.
But they are going to allow waterfowl hunting, is that right?
Yes. The hunting of duck, geese, and coot will be allowed in the waters west of the refuge, and that's going to coincide with the state waterfowl hunting season, which opens briefly in October and then closes again, but basically runs from November to January. And one of the interesting things about this is that area that they are proposing, or they are going to allow waterfowl hunting, is the area that's under dispute between the town and state and the Fish and Wildlife Service because of the jurisdictional issue of along the western edge of Monomoy Island. As you remember, the Fish and Wildlife put forward their management plan, they took sort of asserted jurisdiction of about 3,000 acres of water west of the island. The town and state said, "Wait a minute, we've always overseen that, and we don't believe that you have that jurisdiction." And they're still disputing that.
This has been an ongoing story. Yes,
it's been ongoing. Actually, in the end, though, it won't really matter if that changes, because the state already allows, obviously, waterfowl hunting in state waters. And Matt Hillman says hunters often drift over into that area that's under dispute now, and they've never really enforced any sort of ban out there. So even if the town and state were able to retain jurisdiction of that area, it would just become state waters where hunting is allowed anyway. So basically they're saying, we see no problem with waterfowl hunting out there in either case.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for checking in with us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Now we're going to speak with Josh Balling over at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, big financial questions about the town-owned nursing home. This seems to be coming to a head here.
It's coming to a head, or at least coming to maybe a boiling point. Funding for the R Island Home nursing home is becoming a real big concern for town officials. They've received a recent financial report that revealed the town-owned facility, the only remaining town-owned nursing home in the state, is not only running about $4 million in the red annually, but a much-needed, that pretty much everybody agrees, two-story new building would cost upwards of $50 million to build on the site of the current facility, which is where the community has pretty much deemed that they want it to go. Town officials are also looking for answers on how to continue to maintain the existing facility following a failing federal rating for quality of care and staffing that just came out about a month or so ago. The select board has begun discussing whether they think the community is committed or will remain committed to maintaining a nursing home, either in the current location or a new one, when it's going to require an annual taxpayer subsidy of anywhere in the neighborhood of $3.5 to $5 million. And while that discussion is going on, though, the town still needs to find the best way to fund the nursing home in the interim. And our finance director, Brian Turbitt, believes that the most logical solution is a permanent budget override approved at the upcoming town meeting that would add it right into the town budget. Right now, it's not in the town budget every year. The deficits are addressed on an annual basis. Without that override, he said that money to close the deficit would have to be pulled from elsewhere in the town budget each year, with effects ranging from scaling back on services to cutting staff or employee benefits potentially. In recent years, the town has always seemed to be able to find the money to cover that deficit, but with it staying in the $3.5 to $5 million range, he's not confident that will happen, and says that it really needs to be addressed on a more holistic level.
You've got another story about, it's really about some disagreement among school officials about the use of cell phones in the school. There's an interesting discussion happening here.
It's an interesting discussion happening at Nantucket High School, and I think it's probably happening from what
everywhere.
Our research has shown around the country.
Yes.
And Nantucket High School, like so many others, is really grappling with the issue of what to do about student cell phone use during the school day. And the interesting thing here is that there is a little bit of a disagreement among school officials, although there's no disagreement in the policy. Principal John Buckey and Superintendent Michael Kozort disagree philosophically on whether students should be allowed to use their phones in school. But the superintendent said the call is his principal's to make, and the principal says that students do have permission to use their cell phones in the hallways this year. And that it's up to the teacher's discretion about whether they use them and how they use them in individual classrooms. Cell phone use is not allowed at the elementary and the middle schools. Principal Buckey has taken the position that smartphones are more than just phones. He believes they're educational tools that, when used appropriately, could actually benefit the students. Although many teachers do prohibit their use in class, he says they can be used to figure out complex mathematical equations, can be used to do some research. Superintendent Cozart, on the other hand, says he doesn't believe students need to be glued to their cell phones in the hallways between classes or in class. There are other options for that. He said his job as superintendent, though, is to let his leaders lead. Mm-hmm. And if the faculty believes their time is better spent on things other than having battles with students over cell phones, he can understand that. He says that students do have school-issued Google Chromebooks to use, so they shouldn't necessarily need their phones to do schoolwork.
That's Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us now is Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Good morning, Ed, and welcome back to the Roundup, fronting a new paper for the Outer Cape.
Good morning, Steve. It's great to be back on the radio with you.
Ed, you've got a story about the possible return of the Cape Cod National Seashore Advisory Commission. It's been out of commission for some time now.
Yes, that's right. The Advisory Commission was created in 1961 at the same time that the National Seashore itself was created. And many national parks around the country have these kinds of commissions, but the seashore one here has been unusually active and effective over more than 50 years. And Richard Delaney, who's the president of the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown and was longtime chair of the commission, said that it met over 350 times during that period. But when the Trump administration came in to office in early 2017, suddenly it became much more difficult for the commission to do its work. Part of the legislation that created the seashore established the existence of the advisory commission, but it has a 10-year sunset clause in it. So every 10 years, it has to be reauthorized by Congress. And up until last year, that reauthorization happened just sort of automatically by unanimous consent of Congress. But it didn't happen last year. And in September, just about a year ago, the commission went out of existence because of this sunset clause. Representative William Keating, who represents the Cape, and Senator Edward Markey both introduced legislation in Congress to reauthorize the commission. Last year, that legislation passed the House but failed in the Senate. And what happened this week on Wednesday is that a new bill to reauthorize the commission was unanimously approved in the U.S. House Committee of Natural Resources. It's H.R. 182. And so that means that it's cleared that hurdle and can now go on to the floor of the House. But the problem is still that the chances for its passage in the Senate do not look good, as Delaney told us. Battle in the Senate.
Yeah, what is the pushback? What's the sense of what that pushback is on the federal level not to reauthorize the commission?
Well, it's really not clear. The representatives of the Department of Interior, which controls the National Park Service, said in hearings last year that they were opposed to the reauthorization of the commission, but really didn't give any clear reason for it. They just basically say that this is part of their review of the operation of these kinds of advisory commissions to make sure that they're really following proper procedures. But there's never been any suggestion that anything improper has been done by this commission. In fact, everyone, I think, agrees that it has been remarkably effective in representing the citizens of the six towns that have land in the park. So the way Richard Delaney puts it is simply that Republicans are not very keen on supporting anything that sounds like environmental conservation or protection. And so one of the main issues really facing the seashore here it has to do with climate change, which is certainly the topic of the week. Climate resistance It's really a big deal here.
It really is a big deal. We'll have to rejoin you and find out about what happens with the Cape Cod National Seashore Advisory Commission. We'll all be watching that story as it goes forward. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us this morning.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Steve.
And it is time now to check on action at the State House. And last week, Attorney General Maura Healey decided not to go along with a proposed settlement between dozens of states and Purdue Pharma, the company responsible for producing OxyContin, which prosecutors say helped fuel the opioid epidemic through aggressive marketing on a drug known to be highly addictive. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean for a look at what Healey plans to do.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So, Mike, the Attorney General has decided to stay out of this proposed multi-billion dollar settlement. And Massachusetts is actually in the majority, since most states have not signed on and plan to continue prosecuting Purdue for wrongdoing.
There's almost a partisan split. Well, you'll see a lot of the Republican attorneys general throughout the country going along with this proposed settlement, and many of the Democratic attorneys general just deciding to stay out. And I think, you know, hearing from a lot of those in New York, California, here in Massachusetts, it's pretty clear that those that are staying out are not satisfied with this deal at all. It could be in the billions of dollars, and it could, you know, funnel into anti-opiate, you know, programs, anti-addiction treatment, things like that. However, the attorneys general that are staying out definitely want to be more aggressive when it comes to what they get out of Purdue, and especially the Sackler family, the family that has owned Purdue up until recently when they declared for bankruptcy. So it's kind of a new entity now. That existing deal, of course, was going to be funded kind of with the profits from ongoing sales of OxyContin instead of from the Sacklers themselves. And that's something that Healey kind of rejected outright. She wants to go after that family and expose their role and the managers of Purdue, their role in kind of fueling the opiate epidemic. And honestly, I can't get any better than what Healey said to me about her general take on the deal.
I'm not going to take a bad deal just to take a deal. I think that our state and those affected by this epidemic would want more.
And so, you know, as we said, Healey's not alone. 23 states have signed on to the deal, but 26, including the District of Columbia, they're staying out. And so what it comes to is the Massachusetts prosecution against Purdue will continue in one form or another. More likely, Healey will band together with these other attorneys general who want to be more aggressive, and they'll kind of have a new class action, so to speak, to go after the company.
And also last week, I should mention, New York Attorney General Letitia James accused the Sackler family of transferring $1 billion from their company to Swiss bank accounts that the family holds. So is Healey concerned about the family itself?
Yeah, she's definitely made that clear that she does want to go after and hold the Sackler family responsible. That means not only going after their own personal wealth, which she said that the proposed settlement really didn't do, because like I said, it's funded by future sales, not the profits and earnings that this family has already made. She also wants to kind of get on the record certain documents, certain revelations, so to speak, about what was happening back in 2000, 2005, times like that, when OxyContin was heavily, heavily marketed, what they knew and when they knew it, so to speak. So I think that that kind of personal responsibility on the Sacklers, on Purdue's management, is something that Healey wants to go after. And that's something that could definitely come out in court. And it's something that's not included in this proposed settlement. Healey will probably tell you that the Sackler family is way too protected, not just their wealth, but the documentation and, who knew what. That's also not really going to come out under this proposed settlement. But I think that now that the Purdue company itself is filing for bankruptcy, that changes the ground of play a little bit. These attorneys general are going to get together and see how best to take on this new Purdue entity and this new slightly separated Sackler family to get to the bottom of all this.
I want to switch focus now and take a look at what some of the lawmakers are doing up on Beacon Hill. They're back in formal session this week, and one of their first acts was actually to override a veto that Governor Charlie Baker made last month. Why was this their first action to counteract Baker?
because they didn't get to it before they recessed in August. That's why it was their first. that's the easy answer there. Essentially, this dates back to the U.S. Supreme Court's Janus decision, which allowed public sector union workers to forego paying dues or the equivalent of dues to the union that they aren't really members of, even though they benefit from things like collective bargaining and litigation and things like that. They're part of the bargaining unit. They're not part of the union. This case said that they don't have to pay the dues or equivalent money back to the union for those things. That was a big blow to labor, public sector labor in the United States. What this bill does, it allows in Massachusetts these unions to charge those non-members for specific legal things like arbitration, like legal representation that they all benefit from, so that the unions can at least be made whole on that level. The piece that the governor disagreed with was that this would allow those union bosses to have the kind of email addresses, cell phone numbers, modern contact information of these non-members. The governor was concerned that that would be a privacy issue, didn't like the idea of public sector union leaders knowing someone's email address or cell phone number, thought it could lead to harassment in a kind of worst case scenario. It's important to mention that Baker doesn't disagree with most of this bill. He thinks it's fine to charge for these legal fees and everything, but he didn't like the privacy element of it. It's something that he was intended to send back to the legislature with a change instead of a full veto. But like I said, they were recessed at the time, so it never happened. Now the legislature came back, completely ignored, you know, what Baker wanted to do, and just overrode him completely. And it's important to mention only one Republican voted with Baker initially, and only the same one Republican voted to withstand the veto on Baker's side this time around. So even the other Republicans aren't on Baker's side on this one.
And finally, Mike, the Joint Committee on Export Development had a hearing this week taking a look at the impact of Chinese tariffs on the lobster industry.
The lobster industry obviously is significant in the history and the modernity of Massachusetts. And this is something that a lot of lawmakers around here were surprised to find, that essentially the U.S.-China trade war is now hitting our lobstermen much harder than anyone anticipated. One of the retaliatory Chinese tariffs is against American lobster. This comes as, over the last few years, lobster has become a delicacy over in China. We hear a lot about different products becoming popular overseas and in the massive Chinese market. What happens is with this tariff is that all of a sudden American lobster is 25% more expensive than it was before the tariff. So what does that mean? That means Canadian lobster is being sold at a much higher rate. American lobster is, you know, far more expensive than the Canadian equivalent. At the state level, there's not a ton that the state can do other than give aid to the local lobstermen, you know, the fishing community. They've kind of reached out to the state of Maine, who have a lot more skin in the game than Massachusetts does, quite frankly, as far as the international lobster trade. I believe they have 80% of the American lobster exports. Massachusetts has about 11% of the export market. Like I said, the state can offer aid to lobstermen on this. The biggest thing that they can do, though, is just urge the United States to either do their own type of aid or open up new markets where lobster can be sold, you know, make an effort to sell American lobster elsewhere, or just, you know, tamp down this trade war so that the Chinese take off that lobster tariff. But of course, this is a huge, global, multifaceted thing. You know, you put a tariff on Chinese steel, and then the Chinese put a tariff on American lobster, as well as dozens, if not hundreds, of other products and elements and industries and things like that. So right now, there's a big old trade war, and lobstermen are taking a hit.
And that is WCAI Statehouse reporter Mike Dean talking to us, as he does most weeks, from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks so much.
Great to be with you, Catherine.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Statehouse reporter Mike Dean. That's all the time we have today for the News Roundup, a busy show. I want to thank all our contributors. We spoke to Eve Zuckoff from WCAI, Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We checked in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.